we got a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome, and she had a balanced AV canal defect. When I was pregnant with her, I always tell people I totally feared the wrong diagnosis.
Welcome to Heart with Anna. I am Anna Dvorsky, your host. I'm also a heart mom to an adult who was born with a single ventricle heart and who is 29 years old. That's the reason I'm the host of your program. With me today is Ellen Boyer. Ellen is married to Beau Boyer, and they have three children, Brett, Wells, and Lottie. Brett was born with Down syndrome and a congenital heart defect. Sadly, Brett passed away due to complications from her congenital heart defect. Ellen is with me for today to talk about World Down Syndrome Day. This day has been officially observed by the United Nations since 2012. On March 21st, 2024, the call is for people around the world to end the stereotypes. Ellen and her family started the Brett Boyer Foundation in honor of her daughter. Ellen is the executive director of the Brett Boyer Foundation, and today we'll learn more about that foundation and how you can help them with their mission. After our interview today, Megan Tones and I will take turns reading essays from Chapter 5 of The Heart of a Heart Warrior. You can sign up to take part in a book study of Volume 2 on our website, babyheartspress.com. We'll be discussing the books Thursdays from 5 to 6 p.m. USA Central Daylight Savings Time. We'll discuss the book starting on Thursday, March 21st, which just happens to be World Down Syndrome Day. It's only $10 a session, and anyone is welcome to join at any time. Now on to the show. Welcome to Heart with Anna, Ellen.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad to be with you.
Well, I'm so excited to have a chance to talk to you today and to learn more about your nonprofit organization. So first of all, a mutual friend of ours, Katie Swan, told me I had to meet you and I had to have you on the podcast. And the more I learned about you, the more I realized, oh yeah, she is absolutely right. So I really enjoyed reading about the Brett Boyer Foundation on your website. For those who don't know about this foundation, can you tell us why you started it and what your foundation does or who it helps?
Absolutely. Thank you. And yes, I agree. Katie is just the best. I'm so thankful that she connected us and I'm so thankful to know her. She's such a gift to the CHD community. We started the Brett Boyer Foundation in 2017. My precious firstborn, Brett, we got a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome and she had a balanced AV canal defect. When I was pregnant with her, I always tell people I totally feared the wrong diagnosis. There were a lot of intricacies of her diagnosis of, yes, she might have Down syndrome. No, it looks like low risk. We did not have an amnio. But when we finally found out that she had an AV canal, that kind of solidified the diagnosis for us. And I thought, well, they're telling me that they can fix her heart. Because, you know, they still love to use the term fixed. They can fix her heart, but what about Down syndrome? Because I was so fearful of all the things that they kept telling me she would never do. I was terrified of what it would do to our family, to the dynamic, because I wasn't lucky enough to know and love someone with Down syndrome. So I was so scared of what I didn't know. And then the minute she was born, I realized how wrong I was, that how I had feared the wrong diagnosis, and that Down syndrome was a part of her, and it was a part of her that I would not change for the world, that I'm so grateful that she chose us and that that was a part of her. It wasn't everything about her is a part of her that I just think is wonderful. It's always the top of our mission of the beauties that she taught us is that Down syndrome should be celebrated and does not need a cure, and that CHD needs a cure. And that's what took her from us.
Yeah. Isn't it funny how your world completely changed in what you were thinking and how you were thinking about it? And how interesting that the mission today with World Down Syndrome Day is to stop the stereotypes. And that's exactly what you were having to face yourself.
For sure. Of all the things that they told us that Brett may never do, none of that was considering her heart defect. Those predictions on what she would accomplish with her life were only based on her chromosomes. And I never in a million years, even before we talked about having children, do you think that your child would be able to change the world for an entire massive group of people? And she did, and she has and continues to. There's just so much that I'm so thankful that we never put her in a box the way that sometimes people that are just misinformed and uneducated about Down syndrome, and just so thankful that we get to see her legacy continue. It's just the honor of my life.
It's pretty amazing what people with Down syndrome can do. When my second child, who has a congenital heart defect, was born, we were living out in the country in Texas in a teeny tiny town called Mound. And everybody always says Flower Mound. I'm like, no, that's near Dallas. I was way out in central Texas in the middle of nowhere where there are more cows than there are people.
Wow.
And my neighbor down the street had Down syndrome.
Yeah.
And she wrote a column for Mound for the Gatesville newspaper, because Mound is so tiny, we didn't have our own newspaper, but they always let us have part of the Gatesville newspaper once a week. And she would write the news. So we knew who was having lunch with whom or who went out to a movie. It was like walking back in time when I lived out there. It was amazing. And this woman who was born with Down syndrome, she's in her 50s now. And she was just like the star of the town. She knew everything that was going on, and that was her job. She didn't get paid for it, but that was her mission, was to keep everybody apprised of what's going on in the big metropolis of Mound, Texas.
Making sure her beautiful life, her visibility, her contribution to the town made everybody's stigma about how much value she brings, I mean, to everybody that meets her, and how much each life has such great purpose. Absolutely. The amount of chromosomes that we have don't change that. It amplifies.
No, they don't. Yeah. And, you know, how lovely that we're not all exactly alike, right? I love it that we have different interests. We have different abilities. We have different things that excite us. I was a homeschool mom, and one of my dear friends who was a homeschool mom, we were co-coaches for our children's robotics club. And her aunt has Down syndrome. Her aunt didn't have the same skills that my neighbor did, but her aunt is just such a joy to be around. And when she's with her aunt, they dress up like princesses and they go to tea and they do fun things. I kind of feel like her aunt is a reminder of not ignoring the child in us, and that it's okay to be childlike and see joy in everything, because that's how her aunt is. She just finds joy in everything. And isn't that lovely that we have someone like that in our lives?
I know. And that's what I want to be like. And that's what I want to be around. And I mean, why would you not want to find joy in everything? It's just a beautiful reminder and something that our society needs so badly. I'm so grateful to know and be a part of this community. And I'm so thankful that Brett came to us exactly how she was.
So tell me, now that we've talked about that, what does World Down Syndrome Day mean to you?
World Down Syndrome Day means to me celebrating our differences, like we said before, celebrating what everybody brings to the table, acknowledging that they deserve a seat at the table, and recognizing that all of our strengths are different. And one of the biggest things that Brett taught me is, no matter how old you are, maybe you haven't figured out what your strength is yet, and that you have the ability to see it in other people and to help them recognize it as well.
Yeah, it feels like Brett gave you a whole new mission in life.
Absolutely. And absolutely to never put limitations on yourself, but also to know that you have absolutely no right to put limitations on other people.
Right.
I know you and I talked before we started recording about when we received her diagnosis, we had many doctors that absolutely saw her worth right off the bat. And I'm so grateful that they were so compassionate about honoring her life and recognizing she is our child and is no differently loved than our other two. But there were still a lot of people that immediately put limitations on her before she was even here. And it's so hard as a parent to hear that and not to feel fear immediately. Before she was born, there were a lot of things that I definitely didn't think that I could do. And she brought out good in me that I didn't even know that was in there. That is something that forever, I will never put limitations of what someone is capable of.
I love it. For those who have not visited your website yet, can you give us the URL for your website?
Yes, the website is thebrettboyerfoundation.org. That's Brett with two T's. Our logo is the queen bee because that's what we called her, our Brett, the queen bee. Yellow was just her color. And another thing that kind of made my heart so happy was years before I was even pregnant with her, I had saved in my phone. It said, aerodynamically, the bumblebee shouldn't be able to fly, but the bumblebee doesn't know that, so they just keep on flying anyway. And I was reminded that while I was pregnant and going through all of the emotions that are part of receiving a diagnosis that's scary, anything different is scary. And I read that and I was like, we're not going to tell her what she can and cannot do. We're just going to be along for the ride. And sometimes things take longer and they're that much more of a celebration. And I just want to be part of it. That is why it's all bees and why you'll see the bumblebees flying around on our website.
I love it. I love it. Thank you so much for coming on the program today, Ellen. I have so enjoyed meeting you, hearing about the Brett Boyer Foundation, and I know we're going to be talking about it even more next week.
Thank you, Anna. I've enjoyed it too.
Okay, my friends, that concludes the interview portion of the podcast. We'll take a short break, but when we come back, you'll have a chance to hear my co-editor, Megan Toews, and we read aloud from our new book, The Heart of a Heart Warrior, Volume 2, Endurance, Chapter 5.
This content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed in the podcast are not those of Hearts Unite the Globe, but of the hosts and guests, and are intended to spark discussion about issues pertaining to congenital heart disease or bereavement.
You are listening to Heart with Anna. If you have a question or comment that you would like addressed on our show, please send an email to Anna Jaworski at anna@hearttoheartwithanna.com. That's anna@hearttoheartwithanna.com. Now, back to Heart with Anna.
Endurance. When I was a kid having my surgery in the 1990s, there was very little entertainment available. Our choices included playing Alex Kidd in Miracle World on the Sega Master System 2. Someone had stolen the Wonder Boy cartridge from the box. The Boy Who Could Fly, or Conan the Destroyer. The latter was fairly questionable entertainment for young children, and perhaps that's why we watched it repeatedly. Fun fact, Arnold Schwarzenegger had a bicuspid aortic valve, so it may not have been completely inappropriate. As the youngest in my family with an older brother and older, mostly boy cousins, I ended up seeing a lot of action movies, and the actors seemed to me to be the embodiment of endurance, taking injuries with an almost robotic calm in the pursuit to whatever end. While we may not look or feel like action movie heroes, and we certainly don't have their salaries, we endure nonetheless, as do our loved ones who support us. As time passes, the medical field advances and we may find answers to why we feel and experience what we do, or more questions may be raised. My own experience has been that my health has not been linear. I am healthier at age 40 than I was at 26 thanks to medications not available back then. In the three chapters that form the middle of this book, Service, Motherhood, and Facing My Mortality, you'll meet many others who have endured the challenges that come with reaching adulthood and older age with CHD. In Service, you'll read about heart warriors working in the medical profession, as well as those who have had valuable experiences giving back to the community or enriching their families' lives. In motherhood, you will learn about the unique circumstances that women with CHD face on the road to motherhood and how their experiences in growing up with CHD help them to advocate for their loved ones and community. The final chapter, Facing My Mortality, is a hard read but so worth it for the wisdom the contributors impart, some of whom have since passed away. Chapter 5, Service. If you've read this book from the beginning, you may have noticed that several of the essays are about helping others. For example, Jason Crutchley volunteered with the American Red Cross to repay all the help he received as a child, while Christy Silman became a pediatric cardiology nurse within the ICU to help the children with CHD. These stories showed that there were different ways of giving back, and that in giving, you can gain so much. For example, you may have heard a saying that is some variation of, the best way to help yourself is to help someone else. This chapter expands upon the theme of service. In Monica's essay, Jax, More Than a Service Dog, the quest for a service dog gives Monica a sense of hope and purpose, Jax a loving home, and both of them loving companionship. Tracy Grasty, Victoria Scoggins, and Roslyn Rivera are all in the healthcare field, reciprocating through their work. In her essay, Giving Back, Tracy describes how she had to stop working as an ICU nurse during the pandemic and found herself in a different caring role, helping her parents, now aged in their 80s, as they cared for her as a child. In My Career Choice, Victoria talks about the loving guidance of mentors, which steered her towards a career in healthcare administration rather than the front line. Rosalind's essay, Novik Cardiac Alliance Trips to the Middle East and Eastern Europe, tells the story of her journey from pediatric CHD patient to pediatric CHD nurse, traveling the world to help heal young hearts. My essay, Moonlighting as a CHDer, is about a part-time job I once had volunteering for a medical school program. I must admit I am a bit in awe of my co-authors in this chapter and of what they have achieved. I didn't think I could cut it as a doctor, nurse, or other healthcare professional. However, you don't have to be a medical professional or emergency worker to give back. Even small gestures can make a big difference to somebody's life. Together, these essays show that there are many ways to give back to those in need and in turn receive.
Jax, More Than a Service Dog by Monica A. Mossey. Mid-morning on January 3, 2016, God answered my prayers, but in a much bigger way than I imagined. I was talking on Facebook Messenger when I noticed I had one unread message. At first glance, I caught the words therapy dogs and Lewis H. Mossey. I stared at the message again and saw a link to check out therapy dogs. My heart skipped with excitement at the possibility of my dream finally coming true, if Dad was serious about this. After an intense internal debate on whether I should inquire, I could no longer stand the suspense. I had to know for sure. Dad was sitting in his recliner when I calmly and nervously asked, Dad, the message you sent me, does that mean what I think it does? Looking serious and not saying a word, he nodded yes. I immediately became an emotional wreck. My dream was finally coming true. As soon as I composed myself, I gave Dad a hug. Thank you for making my dream come true, I said with a lump in my throat and tears flowing down my cheek. Still embracing each other, Dad suggested, why don't you do some research? There may be some applications to fill out. Thanks, Dad. I'm planning on it. Sitting in the living room, I looked at the photo of Levi that was my screensaver. Levi, I thought, I love and miss you dearly. You were the best cat anyone could have asked for. I hope you will send me your blessings as I search for a service dog. I browsed the therapy dog's website a bit before I emailed explaining my situation. They responded by telling me their company trained dogs for people who need them as emotional support. Therefore, they could not help me and wished me the best of luck in my search. I thanked them and continued researching. Over the next couple of days, I sent out numerous emails to therapy and service dog organizations explaining my urgent situation. One by one, the replies arrived, rejection after rejection. They were the wrong company, required money up front, or had a 2 to 4 year waiting period for a specially trained dog. I could not wait that long. I needed one right away. I'm so depressed, I said to my mother. I don't want to wait 2 to 4 years. That's too long. Maybe I should adopt a small dog and train him myself. Keep the faith, Mom said sympathetically. I am sure God has something special planned. Why don't you email the Milton Veterinary Hospital? Maybe they can point you in the right direction. I contacted the vet and asked for their assistance. Tears spilled down my cheeks while saying another prayer for a service dog, unaware that my life was about to change the next morning, January 9th. Hello, is this Chico and Friends Saving Dogs? Milton Vet gave me your number. This is Ann Mossy. I'm calling for my daughter Monica. She is unable to hear on the phone. I am looking for information about getting a service dog for her. She needs a small dog because of her heart defect. When I woke up, I was shocked to hear Mom say, Monica, you have to check out Chico and Friends Saving Dogs. Elated and heart pounding, I checked out the Facebook page, browsing through the pictures of dogs available for adoption. I came across a picture of a 2-year-old dog named Jax and instantly fell in love with him. Mom, I am going to inquire about Jax. Mom nodded in agreement. Shaking with excitement, I contacted the owner via Facebook about Jax. I told your mother this little guy would be perfect for you, she replied. Knowing this gave me goosebumps. I knew God was giving me a sign. I scheduled an appointment for the next day since there were 3 other people interested in him. Thank you for letting me meet with Jax tomorrow, I wrote on Facebook Messenger. Lying in bed that evening, I put my hands together and prayed, Dear God, please help me make the right decision regarding Jax. The next morning, Mom and I headed over to Chico and Friends to meet Jax. We introduced ourselves and anxiously waited for the employee to bring Jax out. Here you go, she said, placing Jax in my arms. While holding him, I was unsure if he was the right dog for me. When he laid his head on my shoulder, I had my answer. Filled with mixed happy emotions, I made my decision and adopted a trembling 2-year-old Jax. Thank you, God, I said, with tears sliding down my cheek. After Jax settled in and we got to know each other, it was time to begin the training process. I searched online for a certified dog trainer. Mom, I exclaimed, I found a trainer. A couple of weeks later, Marianne came to my house to meet Jax and me. She asked me what I wanted Jax trained for. I have a complex heart-lung defect and occasionally wear oxygen, I told Marianne. I need Jax to comfort me when I am distressed or sick. Also, I am deaf and wear cochlear implants. I want Jax to alert me when someone rings the doorbell or walks in the house. Marianne made notes, then pulled out a training workbook and pointed out the do's and don'ts. She showed me how to train Jax to alert me when someone was at my house. You need to have Jax's leash tied to you for the next month. That's the only way he'll know that you are his owner. It'll also help him learn about your special health needs, Marianne told me. Jax was one step closer to becoming a service dog. It was time to get him registered. Monica, Mom said, I'm so proud of the work you have done training Jax. He seems so much more comfortable with his job. His little blue vest is so cute. Beaming with pride, I registered him online and anxiously waited for his papers to arrive in the mail. A week later, I received them. Look, Mom, I said upon opening the envelope. Jax is officially a service dog. Mom and I cheered. Even though it was legitimate, it did not feel 100% official until Marianne finalized it. I can't believe this is my 4th and final visit, Marianne said to me. Jax has been doing great work with his training. I am quite impressed. I could not have done this without you. Thank you, I said to Marianne as she left. Jax was exceptional in his training. His intuitiveness amazed me. One day he followed me around and wouldn't stop crying until I checked my blood sugar. He senses my daily battles and incessant pain by sticking to my side. With his help, although difficult at times, I pushed through the rough days. He knows what his vest means and takes his job seriously while wearing it. Once it is off, his personality changes from serious to playful. He knows how to keep me laughing. Jax's enthusiasm and zest for life are infectious. He is truly my kindred spirit. We do not get to choose what happens to us, but we do get to choose how it shapes us. What is life all about for Jax and me? It is about the hope that exists beyond the pain and a journey I never have to make alone. Monica Massey was born on September 6, 1984, with trunchosarteriosis type 2, along with a host of other cardiac and pulmonary conditions. She lives in Vermont with her fur baby Jax, a Chiweenie dog who is her pride and joy. She is an avid reader, enjoys doing cross-stitch, and spending time with her friends and family, especially her two nephews and her niece.
Giving Back by Tracy Grasty. My temperature wouldn't go down. Mum and I were in the emergency room, ER, for the third time. My mum was yelling at the doctors because they thought I had the flu and gave me a shot that didn't work. My fever was up to 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Mum held my hand and reassured me all would be okay. I remember being so scared because the doctors couldn't help me. Then Superwoman showed up. A beautiful black woman pediatric cardiologist. She touched my hand and reassured me and my mother. "I'm going to find out what's going on," she said. She ran tests and discovered I had endocarditis. I was 11 years old. I had to be admitted into the hospital for 1 month on IV penicillin. As a child, it felt like forever. I knew about hospitals. I was born with tricuspid atresia, TA, with hypoplastic right heart syndrome, HRHS. By the time I was 11 years old, I had had two heart surgeries. One was a Blaylock-Taussig Thomas shunt at 15 months, and one was the Waterston shunt at 4.5 years old. I remember little about these surgeries except after the Waterston shunt, I remember going back to the hospital to get my stitches out. In a cold room, they took a set of pliers and removed them. "Ouch," I said repeatedly. It seemed as though I had a million stitches. During my hospital stay, Mum visited every day after teaching school before going home to fix dinner. She sat with me as I ate nasty hospital food and complained about being there. Mum held my hand and comforted me. I anticipated Mum's daily visit, and it always thrilled me. My dad, sister, and brother would sometimes come in the evening. "Thanks for coming," I said to everyone. They would leave me, and my heart would sink every time we said goodbye. That year, I also started wearing a brace for scoliosis. I remember the pain of how it squeezed my body. I could hardly breathe or eat. It went from my chin to the bottom of my butt. Kids teased me because my butt was flat. They would also trip me in the hallway and laugh because it was hard for me to look down. My clothes tore from the nails and I was never comfortable, especially in a chair unless it was upright with no cushion. Every 3 months, Mum would take me for another brace adjustment because I had grown. When the brace would draw tighter, I would feel like my body was in a vice and it was hard to breathe. I had back surgery at 17 years when they placed a Harrington rod inside my back, straightening my spine. I was free. In 1999, I taught school and in the summer, I taught at a daycare. We all went to an indoor play park and the children, 2 to 4 years old, were playing on the slide all by themselves. I thought since I was small, I could get on the slide too, to supervise them more closely. Another co-worker and a friend who was small like me also got on the slide. I thought, surely if this 50-year-old lady can get on the slide, so can I. The slide was a tube and was so fast I couldn't stop and there was nothing to hold on to. I wound around fast and furious. I reached the bottom. Ow! One leg got caught on the mat and I flew forward. The other teachers took the kids away so they wouldn't get scared when the ambulance came and took me and my broken tibia and fibula away. After surgery, my parents came from Detroit to Maryland to take care of me, After a few weeks, Dad went home, but Mum stayed. We went back to my studio apartment. Mum cooked and cleaned. I had a rod placed so there was no plaster cast, but I had a boot to wear. "Your leg looks like it was in a fight and lost," Mum said. There were bruises everywhere. Physical therapy preserved both legs. Mum stayed until I could take care of myself. I was in college when I asked my doctor about how long I would live. He replaced my old doctor who retired. Dr. Ross was straightforward. "You won't live past 26 years old unless you have a surgery called the Fontan," he said. I was 22 years old. Mum started crying. I think that is why my old doctor would hedge and never say how I really was doing. He said, "I expect you'll outlive me," when he was in his late 60s or early 70s. I came out of college for the Fontan. All went swimmingly until I felt like I couldn't breathe. I kept calling the nurses and doctors. I had so many tests, but they couldn't find evidence of my decline on any tests. Meanwhile, I asked for more oxygen, which they reluctantly gave me. One night, I woke up and every staff member was around my bed. "Tracy, you look grey. We need to intubate you." I was so scared. The next thing I knew, I had a tube down my throat. I don't know what hurt more, the tube or my newly operated on chest. I could hear my mum yelling from the hallway at all the doctors and nurses for not believing me when I said I was feeling worse and having trouble breathing. My mum was hot. That little black woman telling off every doctor and nurse she could find must have been something to behold. The intensive care unit, ICU, allowed 15-minute visits every hour. I looked forward to Mum and Dad visiting me. The ICU was cold and I stayed in pain. "Morphine," I said to the nurse. All I wanted was sleep. Sometimes Dad couldn't come, but Mum was always there. A few decades later, I felt my heart beat fast and weird while charting as a pediatric cardiac ICU nurse. I put myself on the heart monitor and couldn't believe my eyes. My heart was beating 250 beats per minute. I was in atrial flutter. They put me on a beta blocker medication that dropped my heart rate to about 35 beats per minute. I could barely get out of the bed. I had no energy. I needed an ablation, a procedure where they burn away the areas of the heart that cause the arrhythmias. Before my ablation, I heard a knock on my house door. "Mum, Dad," they came to take care of me until I had my procedure. A sense of relief washed over me. Years passed, and I visited home more often because my parents became too old to travel. One day, Mum and I went shopping, and as we prepared to leave the mall, Mum couldn't remember which door we came in. I recognized a store and a pillar, so I directed us accordingly. Then Mum couldn't find her car. This never happened. Luckily, I saw a glimpse of a light blue car and went over to it. It was Mum's car. When Mum couldn't find her way home, I knew something was wrong. My phone GPS got us home. "Tracy," Dad said in one of our regular calls, "Mum isn't paying her bills and her phone got cut off." "I did too pay them," Mum said. "I gave them $100 in cash and I don't owe anyone anything." Mum's credit score was 850. She was never late with her bills. I realised I needed to help Mum and Dad. Mum will be 87 later this year and Dad will be 90. I travel from California to Detroit, Michigan at least once a month. When the pandemic happened, I was unable to work my regular job as a pediatric cardiac ICU RN. Since they allowed me to work remotely, I took my computer and stayed in Detroit for several months. Mum has developed Alzheimer's dementia, and she is progressively worsening. She refuses to believe she has Alzheimer's and will not allow me or anyone to bring a care provider, housekeeper, or anyone in the house. It is part of the disease. When I am home, I do what I can. Dad cleans, cooks, and does laundry. Unfortunately, my sister and brother don't come home to help. They refused to come home during the pandemic, even though I begged them to. I wore full personal protective equipment, a Tyvek suit with a hood, a hairnet, booties, mask, and shield, and travelled in first class on a direct Delta flight because first class passengers sat alone. Mum assigned guardianship to me. I started taking care of the bills and paying more attention to her medical issues. Although financially and logistically difficult, I am glad I could do this for her. While I was in Detroit, I got her a mammogram, on blood pressure medication, and a gastroenterologist for her gastroesophageal reflux disease. I helped Dad get his correct medications, appointments, and followed both of their health closely. I still do. Before I left, I made sure they got their COVID vaccinations. "Here, Mum," I said while helping her dress for her podiatry appointment. "You can't wear a slip and pants. Let's wear this pretty shirt. Let me help you with those buttons. It looks like your arthritis is bad today." "She keeps hiding her keys and mail," Dad said. "I do not," Mum said. "You keep taking my things." We both know this is part of the progression of Mum's illness. "It's time for you to have a nurse and physical therapy," the doctor said at one of Mum's appointments. "I don't need strangers in my home. I'm fine," said Mum. "I want to help both my parents, especially my mum, not only because they are my parents, but because they always cared for me when I had CHD problems. Prayerfully, I can give Mum and Dad back a morsel of what they have given me." Tracy Renee Grasty is the youngest of three and was raised in Detroit, Michigan. Tracy was born on September 23, 1966, with tricuspid atresia, aka hyperplastic right heart syndrome or single ventricle. While Tracy is single without children, she does have a pure white pet rabbit named Snowball. A bird lover, Tracy also has a pineapple conure named Sunburst because of her vibrant colors. In the past, Tracy loved to travel and go to live concerts. She followed her favorite singer, Al DeBarge, around the country, attending all of his concerts.
Heart to Heart with Anna is a presentation of Hearts Unite the Globe and is part of the HUG Podcast Network. Hearts Unite the Globe is a nonprofit organization devoted to providing resources to the congenital heart defect community to uplift, empower, and enrich the lives of our community members. If you would like access to free resources pertaining to the CHD community, please visit our website at www.congenitalheartdefects.com for information about CHD, the hospitals that treat children with CHD, summer camps for CHD survivors, and much, much more.
My Career Choice by Victoria Scoggins. Victoria, have you thought about your career? I remember my cardiologist, Dr. Mullen, asking me during a routine follow-up appointment, "Because of your tricuspid atresia and other heart defects, you will have a tough time getting health insurance. It is very important you have insurance that has good coverage, and you can't ever let your policy drop." At 16, this was not a conversation I was ready for or even wanted to think about. I always knew that insurance was going to be an important aspect when choosing a career. Mom would always say, "You need good insurance," whenever I would talk about the future. From an early age, my parents, pediatrician, and cardiologist always reinforced that I would need good health insurance throughout my life and a career that fit my physical abilities. I had an inkling I wanted to work in the medical field. I wanted to be a doctor, but my fear of needles prevented such a vocation. With my frequent visits to my pediatrician, Dr. Tollin's office, I became a regular there and even had my own room. My pediatrician became a family friend and mentor. Knowing my fear of needles and that I had an interest in a career in healthcare, he asked, "Have you ever thought about going into healthcare administration?" Oh, I didn't even know that was an option. He told me to set up a meeting with their office manager, and of course I did. I ended up working in my pediatrician's office during summer vacation and saw firsthand the duties of an office manager. I decided I was going to be in healthcare administration. Now I sought colleges with a healthcare administration program. Unfortunately, I did not find a college that specifically had healthcare administration as a major, so I ended up getting my bachelor's in business administration. During summer vacations, I returned to my small town, and because my pediatrician knew the chief executive officer, CEO, of our local hospital, I was able to have a one-on-one meeting with the CEO to further discuss pursuing healthcare administration. He offered me summer jobs to get hands-on experience and learn about the administrative process of running a hospital. While earning my undergraduate degree in business, I signed up for the only healthcare administration class that was offered. The professor of this class retired from a healthcare organization as CEO. He was someone I needed to talk to and get more insight into this career path I had chosen. Victoria, if you want to get into healthcare administration, you need to think about getting your master's degree. And my professor suggested some universities that had great programs. I took his advice and pursued a master's degree in healthcare administration. During graduate school, I was in a work-study program with the program director, Dr. Mosley. His background was in hospital administration, and his father had been one of the first hospital administrators for the Veterans Administration, VA. With a year left until graduation, he asked me, "What part of healthcare management do you want to go into?" CEO of a children's hospital. Knowing my medical history, he said, "You should look into veteran affairs. They have great benefits and good job security." Since I had multiple open-heart surgeries as a child, I pictured myself working in a children's hospital. Dr. Mosley offered some good points I would need to consider when picking my first job. Perhaps his greatest contribution to my career decision was recommending that I consider working for the Veterans Administration. As I got closer to graduation, he asked, "Have you applied for any of the VA administrative fellowships? You know there are few offered throughout the country and they are very competitive." A few days before my final presentation, he asked, "Have you heard from any of the fellowships you applied for?" "Yes, but I haven't received an offer yet." He looked disappointed but said, "There's still time for the facilities to select their administrative fellows." The next day, I got the call. I was being offered an administrative fellowship. On a final presentation day, Dr. Mosley peeked his head into my office. "It's time for your presentation. Are you ready?" "Yes." After my final presentation, with most of the professors sitting there, Dr. Mosley asked, "Did you get any offers?" "Actually, I got an offer yesterday with the VA for a healthcare administration fellowship, and I have accepted the offer." I have been with the VA for over 14 years, and it has been the best career decision. Over the years, I have worked in 3 VAs in 3 different cities. I have very good benefits that generously cover my increasing medical care costs. While healthcare insurance was always a crucial factor in choosing a career path, I have found a career that gives me satisfaction every day. I get to help veterans, and having great health insurance is just a bonus. From Dr. Mullins to Dr. Mosley and everyone in between, I have had many significant mentors who influenced me and guided me to a successful healthcare career. Victoria Rose Goggins was born in 1983 with tricuspid atresia. Her heart defects were not diagnosed until she was 1 month old, when she was rushed to Texas Children's Hospital for surgery. In 1989, she had the Fontan. Realizing congenital heart defects needed more publicity, in 2014, she started her Wear Purple for CHD Awareness event on Facebook. Although originally from a small town in Texas, she now calls Arizona home. She shares her home with her dog and enjoys working her Sensi business when she's not working her full-time job at the VA hospital as a hospital administrator.
Moonlighting as a CHD by Megan Tones. From the hallway, I hear Dr. Smith lecturing the medical students. When you are taking a patient history for your objective structure clinical exam, you don't have much time, so it's all about pattern recognition. Out of breath from walking up the hill, I wait in the doorway. You need to look for patterns of symptoms to clue you in on what might be going on with the patient. "Ah, Megan," Dr. Smith smiles. "Take a seat. We were just going to start introductions." As we go around the room, I learn the students are from different corners of the world. how exciting it must be to move to another country to study and work. On my turn, I try to sound interesting. My name is Megan. I was born here in Brisbane and work as a rare disease registry curator and researcher. I enjoy travelling and go to Japan nearly every year. Megan is here as one of our patient volunteers, said Dr. Smith. She's going to go back a few years to when she was 22 and first presented to her doctor with a new medical issue. Would anybody like to volunteer as Megan's doctor? They look at me, already turning over facts in their minds. Young, female, working, travelling, and considering possibilities. Finally, a student volunteers and the game begins. My task, to reveal as little as possible about my medical history. I even covered my scar and painted my lips. So, what brings you here today? I want to say, well, a little while back, my pediatric cardiologist told me that my heart has been stable for years and functioning like normal. But I don't believe him because I still take digoxin and my heart randomly races and I sleep all the time and I get puffed out carrying my groceries home. But I am also trying to publish from my honours and get my PhD and write a book and, wow, it's like I'm trying to live my whole life in a few years. But I can't. Instead, I tell them, I'm 22 and I just moved out of home with my husband and dog. I work at a university and will start my PhD soon. When I get home, I just want to sleep. Sometimes I wake up and my face is all puffy like the moon. And when I carry my groceries home, I have to stop walking up the hill. Sometimes my heart beats really fast for no reason. Usually they start down a line of questioning for anemia, pregnancy, or mental illness. Sometimes they raise their eyebrows at the moon face thing, but like me, don't realise that it's water retention. Heart failure from congenital heart defects causes fluid to build up in the darndest places. Most of the time, the student doctor eventually arrives at heart failure. One even asked if I had a history of heart disease, and I played dumb. Gee, I had a few surgeries as a kid, but I'm not really sure what they were. And I still take these little white pills. Guess I should read the box, huh? Once class has discussed my possible diagnoses, Dr. Smith turns to me. So Megan, do you want to tell us what really happened? I'm back, squinting at the bright lights of the consulting room at the university's general practice. Aside from what I told the student doctors, I also said, my heart feels really heavy and dull, like somebody replaced it with a brick or wrapped it in a wet towel. He raised his eyebrows. I'll send you off for some blood tests. There are a few rare things I'd like to rule out. I'm not your typical student patient, am I? I'm more like somebody you might see on that show House. The student doctor nodded. I don't see people like you every day. At the hospital, the gastroenterologist studied my liver ultrasound. Your liver is congested with blood flowing back from the right side of your heart. Finally, an answer to why I struggled to keep up with the other students and missed my school bus nearly every day. And when I got older, wanted to sleep all the time. I took the results with me to the cardiologist. Even then, as I sat in his dingy office with my liver results, he performed an echocardiogram and said, sometimes we see liver problems in Fontan patients, but not in patients with ventricular septal defect, VSD. I don't think your heart would be the cause. I couldn't believe it. I felt like he was treating me like the old maid in a card game. But he did help me, even though I had to take the long way. We could do a catheter and a stress echo to check your heart pressures and how your heart works when exercising. As the classical music played, my cardiologist, surrounded by a registrar and a team of scientists, pressed a needle the size of a pen cap into my femoral artery. Thanks to a local anaesthetic, I felt only a curious pressure, the wires bumping into the sides of my arteries like errant guppies lost on the weight of my heart. I thought of strange science fiction and horror films of the 70s and 80s. Tony Scott's The Hunger at the forefront of my mind. Maybe it was the Hungarian accent of the registrar. I watched my heart on the monitor as the scientist read out numbers. It was almost hypnotic, except when my heart rate spiked a couple of times. the procedure's over, my cardiologist said calmly. We need to remove the wires now. I looked down as the doctors put a towel over the needle. What happened next was a coordinated effort. As my cardiologist removed the needle, the younger registrar pushed down on the wound with all his strength. Even so, the blood flowed like a hose on full power. I stopped looking but felt the towel growing heavier with me. My lower body felt like it was unraveling, my feet detaching, floating away like smoke. I thought of my blood like a magician's silly string squirting from the cuff of a magic jacket. How absurd life is. This isn't as much fun as it looks on True Blood. When would this end? How? Okay, somebody put a hand on my shoulder and a blanket over my shaking body. We stopped the bleeding. It surprised me that I was able to stay on the treadmill for 11 minutes. For the first few minutes, I chatted with the cardiac scientists. What do you think of House? Terrible show. It makes people think that the crazier your doctor is, the better. My cardiologist called me back a few weeks later. Your mitral valve is leaking quite a lot when you exercise. We're going to need to repair it. I had a huge mortgage, 4 new rescue dogs, and was halfway through my PhD. Now is not the time for surgery. Can I have it 2 years from now? I don't think you've got 2 years. He was right about that. Soon, I was out of breath chopping a tomato or tying my shoes. My dogs became my masters. My husband watched helplessly as I lay next to the window, staring at the world I was no longer part of. Finally, in the hospital, a new congenital cardiology team prescribed metoprolol and furosemide. These were, of course, heart failure medications. Only nobody wanted to come out and say I had heart failure. Instead, I was an adult with heart disease. On the third day in hospital, I woke to see my surgeon sitting by the window, bathed in the early morning sunlight like an angel. We can do the surgery in 5 weeks. The last time I volunteered, a student asked me a question I had not heard before. So what happened after the surgery? Do you feel better now? I think I do, I started. Not better, but more stable. The surgeon was very good and saved my valve, but I still have heart failure and arrhythmias. One time I ran into my cardiologist in the car park and I asked him why he told me not to come back as an adult, and why he didn't warn me about what could happen later in life. The student doctors leaned in. What did he say? Asked Dr. Smith. He said, years ago, we felt like if we got you through high school, our job was done. And I thought it would be pessimistic if we told you all those things, and that you might give up on yourself. It's hard to know what to tell patients. There you have it, said Dr. Smith. Sometimes the patient doesn't fit an expected pattern, or the pattern might still be in discovery. Adult congenital cardiology was a very new field at the time of Megan's case. As the lecture resumes, I leave from knowing they are a little wiser about adult congenital heart disease. Maybe I will see one of them again in a consult room, a hospital hallway, or at my bedside and feel that I am in safe hands. Megan Tones was born in Brisbane, Australia in 1983. Her heart condition was discovered at 6 days of age, but she was not formally diagnosed with a large ventricular septal defect, VSD, until 2 years of age. She has had 4 heart surgeries between the ages of 4 months and 25 years. She has worked on a range of research projects in the area of disabilities, education and health, and specializes in research methodology. In her spare time, she enjoys helping the CHD community.
Novik Cardiac Alliance trips to the Middle East and Eastern Europe by Roslyn Rivera. As a citywide speaker is playing the call to prayer in Arabic Awaken Me, I find myself yet again reflecting on how my life has led me to be in Iraq. Having grown up in a suburb of Los Angeles, and attending private Catholic school my entire life, I look back and think that I actually grew up sheltered from the real world. This was likely because my parents' desire to keep me safe from harm. My parents raised me with fear for my health, like any parent who heard the words congenital heart defect. My parents took me home, their newborn baby girl, who was just diagnosed with congenital heart defects, their own hearts shattered, their minds confused, their hopes in limbo. Despite my unknown future, they raised me as they would any child, but with a tremendous secret. They didn't share my diagnosis with my family. My grandmother cared for me, not knowing that my heart was literally a ticking time bomb, lovingly giving me sugar water when I had a boo-boo. I still am amazed that my parents kept this secret, wanting family to treat me like a normal child. It wasn't until I fell into heart failure at age 3 that surgeons touched my heart to repair it. From this moment, my heart became the focus. After my second open-heart surgery at age 10, I knew I wanted to be a pediatric nurse when I grew up. Even with my sometimes failing heart, there was nothing stopping me. Here I am as a pediatric cardiac nurse working alongside an international medical team to provide free cardiac surgery to children in the developing world. When I graduated nursing school at 21, I did not envision that my future would lead me to a country where the language and culture were extremely foreign. This humbling life reflection is cut short as a phone rings in my hotel room. "Good morning," my father said as I answered the phone. Instantly, I am in shock and awe, a state of joy that only my dad's voice could produce. He somehow figured out how to call my hotel in Iraq from California. Hearing him express how proud he was of me for having the courage and determination to travel to Iraq to provide my nursing expertise, words spoken from halfway across the world made my heart so full of love. As my career as a pediatric cardiac nurse advanced, I recognized that congenital heart disease spans the world, regardless of race, culture, religion, politics, or economic status. It became my sole purpose, my passion, to help heal children worldwide, children with CHD just like me. Not only these children with special hearts, but also their parents and families, just as mine were cared for throughout my childhood. My dad was my ultimate supporter, encouraging me when I told him I was leaving California to start travel nursing across the USA, crying tears of joy, and probably fear, when I told him I was now taking my work overseas. Over the past 10 years, I have taken part in medical mission trips to developing countries such as Iraq, Dominican Republic, Libya, Ukraine, Russia, Iran, and Ecuador. Novick Cardiac Alliance provides free life-saving cardiac surgery to children with CHD and medical education to local teams so that they can become sustainable programs. Having spent a total of over 6 months in Ukraine and Libya, places I barely remember learning about in school, and where I didn't know a single word of the language, I now know these places so well that I could take public transportation, and the medical teams are my friends who keep a small part of my heart. As much as I may have taught the local teams, I learned so much more about the world, about language, religion, culture, and hope. I have followed my heart's desires quite literally across the globe. As I prepare for my shift in the Iraqi hospital, I tie my hair up and put on a scarf to cover it out of respect. Looking into the mirror, I notice a faint line of my chest scar and smile. Throughout my travels, the one undeniable thing is that a smile translates in every language. There are numerous remarkable memories ingrained in my brain. A once blue-lipped child walking out of the hospital with a beautiful healing scar on their chest and a new hope for life. A grateful parent repeatedly telling me thank you in their native language. The nurses I've taught CPR to performing these skills to save a child's life. A mother holding her baby in the ICU, scattered with lines and tubes, noticing my chest scar and realizing that there was hope for her baby's future. I believe my heart desired these experiences to feel whole, and I will forever be grateful for being born with CHD. Rosalind Rivera, BSN, RN, CPN, BC, was born July 10, 1983, in Los Angeles, California, with partial AV canal defect, and she had two surgeries in childhood. Rosalind's CHD led her to become a pediatric cardiac nurse. As a nurse, she has worked in 15 U.S. cities and 7 developing countries. She enjoys teaching patients and families about their heart conditions, especially helping her patients learn to take ownership of their health. Rosalind's father was diagnosed with CHD at 57 and unfortunately passed away from complications related to his CHD surgery in 2016. Rosalind volunteers with several CHD organizations, Camp Del Corazon, providing year-round opportunities for children and young adults with CHD, ACHA as a peer mentor, Conquering CHD as a guest blogger, and Hearts Unite the Globe as a medical advisory board member. In her free time, Rosalind enjoys camping and hiking with her husband, Michael, who is a heart transplant recipient, and their 2 dogs. Friends, that concludes this episode of Heart to Heart with Anna. I hope you're enjoying listening to Megan Tones and me read The Heart of a Heart Warrior, Volume 2, Endurance. We are starting a brand new book study for this volume. It meets on Thursdays at 5 p.m. USA Central Time. We only meet for 1 hour. It's kind of like a book club for the CHD community, but we specifically talk about the topics for the essays that we read for that week. Each week, we're going over a different chapter. And then the 4th week, we play a fun Jeopardy game where we go over what we might have learned from the book. It's a lot of fun. I hope you'll join us. You can go to babyheartspress.com to read more about the book studies and to get a ticket to join us. I am limiting it to 12 participants, so all of us have an opportunity to share our own experiences and stories. Have a great week. Talk to you next week. And remember, my friends, you are not alone.
Thank you again for joining us this week. We hope you have become inspired and empowered to become an advocate for the congenital heart community. Heart to Heart with Anna, with your host, Anna Jaworski, can be heard at any time, wherever you get your podcasts. A new episode is released every Tuesday from noon Eastern Time.